Hi, welcome back to Cycling Talk Podcast with me, Georgia Mahoney. Today I'm joined by Q36.5 rider from Australia, Cyrus Monk. It was really interesting to hear about the times that Cyrus has spent on various different teams racing across the world over the past few years, and I really hope that you enjoy listening. Thank you for joining me today, Cyrus.
Thanks, Georgia. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
What's your first memory of being on a bike?
My first memory of being on a bike would be my dad pushing me down a hill. Just basically starting me at the top of a hill, grassy hill, and just letting me go. So yeah, it would have been when I was 4 or 5 years old, I guess, on a picnic with the family. And yeah, just a little bike. I think I maybe had training wheels, stabilizers, whatever you like to call them on the side before then, but this was without them, and I just was at the top of a hill, just no brakes, flying down the hill, got speed wobbles, had a big stack, and yeah, thought I'm never riding this bike again. And then however many years, 20 something years later, I've ridden a bike plenty of times since, so, and had plenty more crashes other than that one.
What's the first bike you remember being really excited about?
I think when I got my first road bike, I was super excited. It was a Giant. I know that it was probably some kind of TCR aluminium. I just remember it was tiny. I think it had 650cc wheels. And I remember being just super excited because I'd been racing the local road races on a mountain bike with the local club, and to have a road bike with the skinny tires and hopefully be able to keep up with the other kids, then I was super excited.
I think it feels like a big moment when you're a young kid and then you get a bike with drops and you feel like you can be aero and super cool compared to just riding on a mountain bike.
Yeah, especially the mountain bike in a road race. I think everyone's been there when they start out, and you think you'll be fine to just get a mountain bike out there on the road and keep up with everyone. But it's unfortunately it does make a big difference.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about where you're from?
So I'm from a small country town called Druin in Victoria in Australia. It's an amazing place to ride a bike, honestly. It's as soon as you're out of the, it's a small town by itself. It's grown a bit now since when I was first riding, but as soon as you're out of town, you come across almost no cars. You might see the odd tractor or two or farm truck, but apart from that, yeah, it's really nice rolling hills. It's in basically a big valley, so you've got some nice climbs on both sides, not so far from the town. So when I was starting out as a young kid, it was really tricky in terms of there's no real flat roads. But now when I go back there to train, that's one of the favorite things I like, is that it's constantly rolling terrain without even trying. I'm getting just good power output on training rides there, and I really enjoy going back there to train. Of all the places in the world that I've ridden a bike, it's still one of my favorites.
That sounds amazing. Do you remember when you really got into cycling?
Yeah, so it was probably around when I was 9 years old, I think. We were really lucky where I was. There's the Warragul Cycling Club, the town closest to mine, really good junior program on the velodrome there. So I started, they own a lot of track bikes, and we have a really good outdoor velodrome, 333 meters and pretty good banking. And yeah, we used to go down there on Tuesday nights and have a good group of us juniors would just go there, use the club track bikes. Everyone had a similar old steel frame bike, not fancy at all, but no one really cared. And we'd just go out there and race each other, basically. Learned a lot of skills from that. Got some love for racing, for really comparing myself against the other riders. And yeah, from then on, moved onto more road racing and actually training in between, rather than just showing up to these track sessions and racing. Then sort of obviously worked out from there that you need to train to be good at that sport. And really from then just really loved the competitive aspect, and also the just being able to ride with my mates.
And from that point, did you start to progress to national racing, or were you just doing regional racing at that time?
Really just regional racing. I was still playing a lot of other sports as a junior. So I was more interested in Aussie rules football in winter and then cricket in summer. So those were taking up most of my weekends. And then if I was lucky, I'd have time in the afternoons on Saturday to get down to a club race on the road. And then even then it was, mostly racing in D grade it was then, and not even racing, just trying to finish one lap with the D graders. And if I could do that, then the next week I'd try and finish two laps of maybe a 10K circuit or something like that. So I was never particularly strong as a junior at all. It wasn't until I really started putting the hard work in and training a lot as, like getting into under 17s, under 19s, and then started getting some better results at state level then. And then it wasn't until really under 23s that I started doing these national level races and seeing some success at that level.
Wow. I know you were at uni when you were 18. Can you tell me about this time and how it helped with your racing progression?
Yeah, I went to university straight out of school, which is pretty common in Australia. You get some people take a gap year, but I picked up my stuff and moved to Melbourne as basically as soon as I finished school, and then was that was actually really good for my cycling because I then was racing the criteriums in Melbourne, had all of a sudden a lot more people to train with, had bunch rides to do on the weekends and some weekday mornings. So then it became a lot more social, the riding side of things and the racing side of things. And then also while I was at university, it was actually pretty easy for me to fit my training in around university. All of a sudden, instead of at school, I was in a classroom 30 hours a week or more. And then university, it was still a lot of contact hours in my Bachelor of Science degree, but it was more around the 20 hours per week mark. So I had more time to train, and I could also stack all of my classes on one day or in the evenings. So then I had more time in the mornings to train. And it wasn't so much that I scheduled the uni around training. It was always prioritizing the university and then training around that. But they really fitted in quite well, and I think they both helped each other as well.
And you did some racing in Belgium at that time. Was this your first time getting the opportunity to race outside of Australia?
Yeah, in 2016, so second year at university, I was able to the team I was racing for at the time, just a small Australian amateur team, we did a block of racing in Belgium in the middle of the year, and that was still self-funded, but the team helped us out a bit with accommodation and transport to and from the races and some support at the races. So that was really good. But it was definitely the first race when I went over there. It was just a massive shock to the system, all of a sudden starting in a bunch of over 100 riders. Like in Australia in the national series, we had some bunches 60, 70, 80, but not such a deep level of talent and not such technical racing around such chaotic circuits really. So that was really throwing myself in the deep end. I think the first race I started, I was out by about halfway through and thinking, geez, these guys are way too good for me. But then pretty soon after, found my feet there and was able to take some podiums and then some wins pretty soon after at the amateur level there, and really got a taste for the racing in Europe from that experience in Belgium.
And was it from this that you joined DratPack, Pat's Veg Holistic Development Team?
Yeah, so the team, the amateur team that I went to was called Pat's Veg. So it was always associated with the DratPack team, which had a lot of iterations over the years. And it was at that time when I was there, there was a pro continental team, and I was part of the amateur team, which was essentially like a feeder team to that. And then that sort of shifted while I was there. So a lot of the sponsorship from the DratPack went into the World Tour team, which was at the time Cannondale. And then we had a continental team, which I was part of, DratPack Pat's Veg. And so I did a lot of racing with DratPack Pat's Veg then. And we got to do a lot of racing in Belgium the following year, which is good. Some UCI level races and a lot of pro kermesses as well. And then from then, I was lucky enough to also get a chance to stagiaire with the Cannondale DratPack World Tour team.
And what sort of racing were you doing with the World Tour team?
My first race was a race in the Netherlands, actually called Veenendaal. Veenendaal. I've done that race many times since now, actually with different teams. But that was a flat sprinter race, and basically we went there with a good sprinter, and I was just told to get on the front and just ride the front as long as possible to keep the breakaway under control. So that was my first real experience of domestique work and working completely for someone else, because I'd been in teams before where I'd definitely work for others, but here it was just destroying myself and not having any chance of a final result because that was my job at the time. And then I also in that season got to race in Canada at Tour of Alberta, which doesn't exist anymore, but that was a great experience going over there to race in a stage race, and the team was really successful when we were there. And then at the end of the year, got to do some of the autumn classics in Italy. So I got a really varied program that year, and it was great to race with the riders at the top level, and then also just to experience those races, see how good that top level was, and see the work that I needed to do to get there.
You said obviously you were doing domestique work at that time. Did you have a hope for what kind of rider you wanted to become, or was that something that you wanted to be?
No, I don't know that anyone starts their career thinking they want to be a domestique for the rest of their career, but as well, if I guess most people would take a good career as a long career as a domestique over no career at all. So at the time, I didn't really know exactly what kind of rider I was going to be. Still don't really fit into any particular slot. I think the racing in Australia always requires versatility, so the ability to climb, sprint strong enough to be able to stay away in breakaways, the ability to read a race when it's splitting to bits, because the racing in Australia isn't so controlled. So it's not like you can just back your sprint and sit in the whole day and hope to sprint at the end. And we also don't have so many races that are up really long climbs. So it's always a little bit of an in-between rider that is successful in Australia. And then I found that that was also the case in Belgium, where you needed to be strong enough to make it into the split that was racing for the win, but then also fast enough to have a finish at the end. So that kind of versatility definitely helped me perform well enough to get to the top level. And then at the top level, it almost felt like I didn't have a specialty that was strong enough to succeed in any of the races on my own. So it was often then using the skill set that I had to support others. And that's often still the case currently. It'll depend at which race I'm at and what is required. But I think definitely my strength is my versatility, but in a way you can also see it as a weakness that I don't have one specialty that I'm particularly strong in. And yeah, nothing where I'm at a world-class level, but across all aspects of my riding, I think yeah, I'm competitive, and then there's nothing where I'm going to beat the best guys in any particular area.
Well, you're pretty good at time trialing. You came fourth in the under 23 national champs in 2018. I understand that was a pretty close race. What was that like?
Yeah, that was the when I really had done a lot of specific preparation for time trials at that time. So yeah, I was never particularly good at it in juniors. I hadn't done a lot of work in it, basically because I could never afford a time trial bike. And then I was racing for a team that could get me a time trial bike, and I realized, okay, I'm actually strong enough here, and yeah, able to hold the power in a good in a aerodynamic position. So this is something that I can target. And then yeah, the field at that level in the Australian under 23 races, you're always racing against guys that are either in the World Tour already or essentially going to the World Tour. So it is a high level, and to be yeah really close to those top guys in that, I sort of realized, okay, I've got to be enough engine that I can't use that as an excuse for not being able to do something. So I knew I had a reasonable kick at the end of a race. I knew I knew how to read a race pretty well, but then I realized, okay, I've got the engine here. And it's not something I was able to continue working on that much, just because I wasn't for the following years actually doing that many TTs. But it is something that I still enjoy working on when I get the opportunity, and it's something that I've maintained as a strength, I think, throughout my career is when there's a TT that I can really target, then it's something that I can do well in still.
Yeah. And you went on to take the win in the Antetokounmpo road race. What do you remember from that race and that win?
It was a really funny day, that one, because it was so hot. The race got shortened and moved to really early in the morning. So a lot of people were thrown a little bit. I was personally really annoyed because I'd come off a season racing in Europe. I had some good fitness from racing with a World Tour team, and I wanted the race to be as long and as hard as possible. And the fact that it was shortened, I was really annoyed. But as it turned out, it was hot enough, hard enough still, that it split to bits, and there wasn't so many left in the last 20 Ks, and I was able to ride away from them and win solo. So that's still one of the days I look back on most fondly in my career, just because the result was massive for me. To win any kind of national championship, I think, is something that anyone can be proud of. But then also, just to be able to, I don't get to race in Australia so much, so to be able to share that result with the friends and the family that were there, to be able to see, to share that with everyone else was really nice.
And then after some results in the Herald Sun Tour, you did the Oceania Continental Championships in Tasmania. You had another fourth place in the TT and then a bronze in the Antetokounmpo road race. Did this give you confidence going to Europe shortly afterwards?
Yeah, it definitely did. I think that kind of racing in Australia, when we have a championship race, whether it's national championships or the Oceania championships, it's often a similar kind of field, and the racing is so selective in that there's never the control from teams in Australia to wait, bring something back together and have a race of 10, 20K at the end where everyone goes all out. It's generally from the start, everyone going full gas, and whoever's there left at the end is the strongest. So if you're getting results in those kind of races, it means you've got the legs, basically. There's no hiding in those kind of races. So when I was, finding those races so difficult, but then looking around and there'd be no one else there at the end of them, and to take some results like that was really good for the confidence. I still didn't know what to expect compared to a European field, but I think, the coming off a summer in Australia of hard racing, and then being able to really work on the top end with some races just before heading to Europe, I think if you're able to do that well and manage the load and still stay fresh before coming to Europe, then it's really good for both the confidence from getting those race results and then also just having that condition.
And when you went to Europe, you got a 10th place in the Tour of Flanders Nation Cup, followed by 27th in the next round in the ZLM Tour in the Netherlands. And then you went to the other side of the world for Tour Korea. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so at that time I was really pushing hard to get a contract, a full contract with the World Tour team. So I'd done the stage there the year before. I was part of the development team for that World Tour team, and I was reigning under 23 national champion. So basically, I just needed some results in Europe to show that I was capable of performing on that side of the world. A lot of people can show themselves in Australia but aren't capable of them performing well in Europe, and while most of the racing that is done at the World Tour is in Europe, so if you're unable to perform well in Europe, then you're going to struggle to get a ride at the top level. So for me, getting that top 10 in Flanders was really promising. I thought, okay, I should be a good chance now to get the World Tour contract. And then the development team I was racing for was then racing in Korea, and I actually went there feeling pretty good about getting a result there as well and riding on the GC. And then the very first day of that tour, I got really bad food poisoning. I don't know what it, Korea's not somewhere that's usually known for having food that's too dodgy, but then that tour I was completely on my hands and knees and good for nothing. And then that was quite frustrating because at that time I knew I just needed to keep getting results to show what I was capable of. And then something that was completely out of my control just wiped me out. And then I had to pull out of that race, and then also took me a bit of a time to recover from that to try and prepare for the next race block as well.
Yeah, after some mixed results back in Belgium, you joined the World Tour team again for Omloop Van Het Hoogland. What was this race like, and what were your emotions at that time?
Yeah, so at that time it was, I knew it was going to be tricky for me to get a contract because it was getting late in the year and I still hadn't got the piece. Like, I had good conversations, but I didn't have a piece of paper in front of me with a signature on it. So that is, yeah, always the final hurdle to jump, and I hadn't jumped that yet. And it was, I think, September at that point, and I was starting to get a bit worried. And then, yeah, I think at that time I was just letting the stress get to me of thinking, oh, what am I going to be doing next year? Still don't have a ride. I've graduated. I just finished university, and I thought, right, now it's crunch time. Like, I need to have a contract now, or it's all for nothing. And I still didn't have the contract, and there was no reason I shouldn't have been able to ride well, but I was just letting the stress get to me. I wasn't sleeping well, I wasn't eating well, and then the performance started dropping. So I think the races that I did at the start of that second stagiaire with the World Tour team, I was mentally so hungry for it, but physically I just wasn't at the top level because I'd been stressed, yeah, and really just not nailing those key things that you have to do to be able to perform at any level, really, let alone the top level. So yeah, I was maybe 10 or 20% off my best at that point when I needed to be 10% better than my best to be getting results in those top level races. So that then compounded the stress, and yeah, I just wasn't able to get the most out of myself.
So it's like you always wanted it too much, but is that something that you've learned from in the last few years when you're looking for contracts with other teams about not letting it get to you too much and focusing on the things off of the bike as well?
Yeah, definitely. That's something I've learned from, and something I always try to pass on. So with, yeah, even in the situation before being able to join this team, like, I had to take a step back from the top level of the sport, not by choice, just because I didn't have a contract at the top level. And then it was, I wasn't even thinking, oh, I desperately need to get this contract, I need results so that I can get paid to ride. It was just, okay, I've got this race coming up, let's make sure I enjoy this race, enjoy the training leading up to it, enjoy these sessions, make sure I'm feeling well. And then it was, yeah, more just focusing on the little things in between rather than this big picture. And those, yeah, all add up together. And then I was getting really good results at that time. And then I think, yeah, it's like, with anything, the only way that you can guarantee that you're gonna be able to progress in the sport is to consistently get results. Obviously, there's work that you can do as a domestic that can be noticed by people, and you can show your face in breakaways or in the front of the peloton, but results is always something that you can't hide. Like, they speak for themselves when you have good results. So that happened when I wasn't searching so desperately for them in a way. I was just more focusing on the process rather than the end goal. And then, yeah, to that extent, I was able to get those results, which then landed me the contract when I wasn't ever thinking, oh, I desperately need this contract. But then, yeah, I was able to get a pro contract from that. And then, even in this situation now, I'm not so focused on, oh, when will I get the next contract? What's going to happen next? What do I have to do to get to this point? Instead, I'm just focusing on, okay, this is my next race. How can I best prepare for the next race? Or even breaking it down more to, this is my next training session. What do I need to eat to be good for this next training session? How much sleep do I need to get to be good for this next session? And just those little things, rather than focusing on always the big picture, because so much of that can be out of your own control. So if I just focus on the little things that I can control, and then the rest tends to take care of itself really well.
That's really interesting. Before you ended your 2018 season, you represented Australia at the World Champs in Innsbruck, Austria. What was it like to wear the national jersey and represent your country?
That was really special. It was something that I, yeah, so desperately wanted to have that opportunity to race there. Looking back, and at the time, deep down, I knew it wasn't a course that suited me whatsoever. I so wanted to be there, but that course was, yeah, built for pure climbers, and I wasn't at the peak of my ability when I've really targeted climbs. Maybe I would have been able to, yeah, to finish in somewhere between 40th and 60th. And at that time, I'd been focusing mostly on flat races in Belgium. So, and then I got a pretty late call up to go and race there. Packed up all my stuff and went to Girona for, I think I had 2 weeks to try and get good on the climbs, and then tried to cram so much in there. Got sick actually just before the race because I'd been just trying to cram in the training, not eating because I was trying to lose weight really quickly as well to be good on the climbs. And then got to Worlds sick, overtrained, and then the performance was pretty terrible there. So then that sort of compounded the stress of that was my chance to show everyone what I could do and get a contract either with EF or with any team. And then all of a sudden, yeah, wasn't able to even finish the race. Was one of my worst rides because of all those reasons. And yeah, that was another one where it was just, if things had gone differently, then maybe it would have worked okay. But it's also one that I look back on now and just think, oh, I'm so happy that I got to I can always say that I got to race at a world championships, even at under 23 level. And yeah, hopefully one day I get to do another one with Australia, but that's definitely an experience I can draw from as well, being able to race with the national team.
Yeah. So you started 2019 with Conti team Evo Pro Racing. Can you tell me a bit more about this move and how you got the chance to join that team?
Yeah, so at the end of 2018, I didn't get the big contract that I was searching so desperately for. And then it was a matter of just scrambling to try and find anywhere to race in Europe. So racing in results in Australia, while they're good personally, makes it really hard to get a ride at the top level because there's not many UCI races in Australia. There's not many opportunities to really show what you can do against the top level of the sport. So I knew I needed to be in a team that allowed me to race in Europe. And this Irish team popped up. I had a contact there that was going there as a soigneur, and he was able to get me a ride there really late in the year, which was definitely fortunate for me because then it just gave me an opportunity to race. And the team wasn't particularly well organized in the first year. We were really just struggling to get to races, let alone form well in them. But then for me personally, I was actually just that chance to get to race. I was able to show myself a lot in the races that I did with them. And then also the team was taking nice results. So I got some inspiration from other riders within the team, just watching them take some nice results, seeing that, okay, I'm not far away from them in terms of the numbers side of things, the training side of things, a few more things go my way and I can get some similar results and move on to bigger things as well.
But you had a big season that year, and it started with national champs before New Zealand Cycle Classic and Herald Sun Tour stage races. Do you feel like you get much of a break when racing starts so early in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yeah, we really do race almost year round, but it's something that I've always been used to because I guess even as a kid, I was playing sport year round. There was never really a break because as soon as I finished one sport, the season for another sport would start. And then even in Australia, we race through the winter. So for me, a big off season isn't something that I feel like I need. It definitely is something that I've had to learn to take a break at some point, more for the mental side of things than the physical side of things. But yeah, it's hard to be at the top level year round. So often it happens even without trying too hard in the Australian summer because it's so easy to do the long hours in November and December in Australia. And then we have so many local criteriums. By the time you're doing those with some long hours, you end up being really fit with it, even if you're not putting in hard interval sessions every day. So for that reason, I was always going well in January and February. So for our national championships in January and then in February at the Sun Tour, I always had good form. So then it was really hard to still be in good form for the European season if I didn't at some point, yeah, manage the load there. And often it wasn't a conscious choice of, okay, I'm going to make sure I'm good for this month and this month. It just happened because some months I'd be a bit overcooked, need to take a little break just because I was cooked, or get the chance to take a break maybe because I didn't have as many races, and then I'd come back and then be good once I had that chance to build up again and be good for later on. So Yeah, it's a tricky one because now I definitely periodize it a little bit more heavily, but at the time I was just happy to do any race I got a chance to do. So, and then I was just hoping to perform well at every race. So I didn't really pick, okay, this is when I'm going to be going well and this is when I'm going to take a break.
And I've noticed a lot more World Tour riders from Europe in the past couple of years have started their season in Australia. As a Australian rider that's done that for so many years, do you like having World Tour riders there from Europe, or do you prefer it when it's people from your country?
I think it is really cool in if I'm racing a local criterium in Melbourne and some World Tour riders from Europe show up, that's really cool. And it really inspires the riders in Australia. They don't get a chance to go and watch these guys in the Tour de France or that kind of thing because it's a crazy investment to go and watch those races. Or even there's Tour Down Under in Australia, which is great for people to go and watch. And then the fact that more people are going out to train in the weeks before is also cool to have them around. For me personally, from the competitive aspect, I preferred when they used to just not train so hard in the winter. And then I found, when I started that if I raced against Europeans in March or even April, I was consistently stronger than them because I'd have just come off 2 or 3 months of really good training, whereas they'd have just been stuck inside and training on the turbo. There wasn't as much investment in training camps back then. You wouldn't have everyone staying in Spain for months at a time. There was more just they'd ease into the season a bit more. Whereas I think now, there's the training camps in Spain, a lot are coming out to Australia, even Colombia, that kind of thing. So it just means that at the start of the season, everyone's flying. It's not just Australians and anyone from the Southern Hemisphere. The whole peloton is flying.
Well, you raced in 9 different countries in 2019, including Serbia, Hungary, and China. How do you think the racing varies in these different countries?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to race in so many different countries throughout my career, and it's something I really love is the difference there is. I think, it's hard to describe actually how different the racing really is when you change continents, and even within Europe, in different races, how the racing changes. It's something I noticed when I went to the World Tour team and did some races in Italy, how everything is so relaxed in the beginning, piano, piano, and then at the end, it just ramps up to astronomical levels. And then I was, because I'd always just think, oh, I'm right in the race here. There's only 30, 40K to go, and I'm still right here at the front. And then all of a sudden, they're just going crazy. Whereas you can race in Belgium and it's just full gas from the start. And if you're not there for the first crosswind split, then that's your race done. But then, the racing in Eastern Europe then is often on really big wide roads, positioning isn't as much of a factor. There's more impact of temperature. And then I guess it's similar racing in Asia as well. Like you just get these really tough climates to race in, extreme heat. The roads and skills, I guess, in the bunch aren't as much of a factor. But then the thing I love about racing Eastern Europe and Asia as well is you get just chaos before and after the race even starts. So like you'll get to an airport, you'll have this bus transfer in a random, like some guy will be standing there with a sign with your name on it. He'll throw you in the back of a bus. Your bike gets chucked in a different truck that you don't even know if it's going to go to the same hotel or not. And it's just chaos even getting to the start. Your phone doesn't work, so you don't really know where you are. You don't know if you've been kidnapped or you're going to the right hotel. But for me, I had that experience pretty early on racing in Asia with Australian teams. And then I think it's always something that really throws off the top level riders because they're used to the really controlled environment that's set up by the European teams. And then when they go out of that comfort zone to there, then their head can be out of the game when they get to the start line. Whereas for me, it's something that I always just can see the funny side, treat it as a bit of a holiday rather than a race until I'm actually in the race itself. And then that way I'm not getting so stressed about, oh, what is going on with the food at this buffet or what is going on with the transfer to this race start? Why are we in crazy traffic where it feels like we're going to die? So those aspects, I really see the funny side and I'm able to adapt pretty well to those situations, I think. Whereas you get a lot of people that haven't experienced those situations as much, and then they really struggle to perform in those environments.
After I've packed a calendar in 2019, 2020 was a bit different. You raced the Elite National Champs in January before GP Monster in early March. Where were you when the world went into lockdown?
We were in Belgium. We were in an Airbnb with the Evo Pro team, and yeah, we just got the call from the team boss. I don't think we're going to be racing tomorrow. I think we had a race planned in the Netherlands that we were going to head to, and then it was okay, we're not going to travel to the race. We're going to stay here, and that pretty quickly turned to okay, we're packing up everything and we're going back to Ireland, which for a lot of the guys in the team was home, but for me it was a long way from home. But at the time, I thought, okay, I'm better off going back to Ireland. This will all blow over in a few weeks, and then I'll be able to get back to Belgium easily to race again once the season kicks back up. And then, yeah, as it turned out, it didn't blow over in a few weeks, and I was stuck in Ireland for quite a long time, which, yeah, it wasn't possible to get back to Australia then. So then it was, yeah, a long time without a focus on riding at all, and it was, yeah, really different experience, I think, my lockdown experience, because I wasn't stuck at home, I was stuck on the other side of the world.
And what other things did you do when you were spending that time in Ireland other than just riding?
Yeah, I got to do it quite a lot actually. I bought a guitar pretty early on in the lockdown because I've always been someone that's been quite musical, and that kept me busy. I basically wrote an album worth of songs while I was there because I had so much time on my hands and not much to do that I was able to get quite creative there and, yeah, write a few songs. I was able to the I was staying with the team boss of Evo Pro at the time, and he sort of rekindled his love for fishing when I was there, and we'd take the boat out and just go fly fishing for trout a lot of days out there, and that was just a way to kill the time and a nice way to spend the time. And then once the restrictions sort of eased up a bit, I was just going out on my bike and basically doing these tourist rides where I'd ride for 7, 8, 9 hours just to ride to a city I hadn't seen before, go and check it out, and then turn around and ride home. So there were some pretty epic long days on the bike, not for training, but just because it was a cool way for me to see the country while I was there.
And you did some racing towards the end of the summer in Ireland, and then just a few races in Europe. How did it feel to be back racing after all that time?
It was great to be back racing, but I feel like I didn't use my time in the lockdown as anywhere near as well as others. So while I was training during the lockdown in Ireland, I wanted to keep riding my bike, but I didn't know how long it was till the racing started. I didn't have any specific goals because I didn't have any specific races to train for. So my training was then I just rode 100K every day, and I did that for I think 50 days in a row. So yeah, a month and a half of just riding 100K, not with any particular intervals, obviously no rest days in there or anything to do that. And then I thought, okay, this will keep me fit. But really, I just got quite slow because I never had any intervals or fast training. So I could ride all day, I found, and I showed up to some races at the end of the summer there, and I had this crazy endurance, but as soon as the pace was high, I was getting dropped. And then as well as that, I found the same when I went back over to Europe to race there. I was a big diesel engine, and for someone like me that, yeah, it would have been fine maybe if I was in a team where they required someone to ride the front all day, but really we needed the people in the breakaways, and I didn't have the punch to get into a breakaway because I hadn't done any of that kind of training, and I didn't have the punch to then finish off the races really well at the end. So yeah, I wasn't able to actually get much out of that 2020 season in the end.
But it is really difficult to train without an end goal. And obviously, when you're in a smaller team as well, you're probably getting less news about when racing's coming back. Whereas I've spoken to riders and they were getting told, like, oh, this is the next race, and then it would get cancelled. But at least it's something that you have to sort of push you on.
Yeah, definitely. And at the time, we were a team that we didn't know which races we were going to get invited to because a lot of the World Tour teams wanted to race everything because no one had raced for a fair while. And yeah, there was this mad rush where we would be on the invite list for a race and then all of a sudden we'd get taken off it. And then sometimes vice versa, we didn't know we were going to be racing something and then we'd be put on it. So yeah, it was definitely it was cool to be able to do some races there, but I wasn't at a level where I could actually perform my best in them. But it's something that it was nice to do them because I've had a chance to do a lot of them since then, and then to know the races better, even if I wasn't performing super well, then has helped me in the following years.
Yeah. So as you said, you're pretty musical. Can you tell me about your 14-day quarantine music videos?
Yeah, I got unfortunately stuck like a lot of Australians in hotel quarantine, and it was never something I planned to do while I was in there. I just knew I was going to struggle to pass the time. And I actually, during my travels in Europe, I'd bought a harmonica and a tin whistle just on the way back from visiting my sister in Germany and going to Ireland to then fly back to Australia. I'd bought a few of these little instruments, and then because it was easy to travel with them. And then I got to hotel quarantine. I think the first day I made a stupid one because I was bored and had the time to. And then a lot of people found it pretty funny. I think a lot of people as well, because there was lockdown most places in the world at that time. Everyone was glued to their phones and on social media. So it got a fair bit of interest when I started doing it. And then I just thought, well, I've got 16 hours a day while I'm awake to spend trying to do something while I'm in this hotel room. So I was, yeah, spending 3 or 4 hours of those each day just making these silly little music videos, which, yeah, ended up getting on the news in Australia and finding their way around a lot further than I thought they would. But I think a lot of people just like to see someone actually making the most of their time in the hotel quarantine, because there's a lot of kickback from everyone about having to do it. So for me, it was good to actually use it to do something positive and that gave people a laugh.
Yeah, they are pretty cool. You got to spend Christmas at home in Australia, and then you started your 2021 season down under with the National Champs and the Santos Festival of Cycling with Cycle House Oz. Tell me about how this racing went for you.
Yeah, I started that year really, really well, which is surprising because I'd obviously spent the time in hotel quarantine. I couldn't ride at all, and I hadn't finished 2020 with great form. But I think just being home, training really well, and at that point, I wasn't so focused on, okay, I need to be getting this result for this reason, or I need to be doing this. I was just racing with a small domestic Australian team full of mates that I'd ridden with either before, or guys that I was sort of mentoring to get to the level that I'd been at before, and trying to set an example for them, I guess, in the way that I was training and racing. And yeah, it was really just carefree, stress-free. By chance, showed up to that Santos Festival of Cycling and had, yeah, good enough legs and was, I guess, crafty enough to get into the breakaway every day there and pick up a lot of time bonuses and sprint points along the way, and win the sprint jersey there against a lot of World Tour riders. So that was cool to just go, hang on, I still can race really well against this level of rider. I still really enjoy racing the top level domestically, and when I'm in an environment that's really positive and that I can have a bit of fun, then the performance can be really good as well. I don't need to put so much stress on everything, and I don't need to be, yeah, doing everything by the exact number. If I'm in a good headspace and, yeah, with a good group of people, then I can perform really well.
And back out in Europe, you went to race Valencia, and then you went back to Serbia, and you took a second place finish in stage three, and you finished fourth place in the GC. Did this make you feel confident heading into what you were hoping to be a busy summer of racing?
Yeah, that was really good to go back there because I'd raced it before and I wasn't in great form the last time I raced it, but I knew the courses. I knew I was coming in with better form from having raced in Australia and then also having a really high level race in Valencia, where I'd got to Valencia with a lot of jet lag from Australia. I think I was one day off the plane, and it was always going to be a training race for me. which was mentally challenging, getting, just dropped almost every day by the top level riders. But I knew it was to use that race for conditioning for the next races. And then, to be able to show what I could do in Belgrade Banja Luka was in that race in Serbia was, really cool to show that, while it's not a top level race in Europe by any stretch, that I was capable of getting results at in Europe, and gave me some confidence for the rest of the season.
Yeah. And then lots more racing in the summer with racing in Belgium, Norway, France, and the Netherlands. Can you tell me a bit more about what your role was in the team at that point and how you felt you developed as a rider in 2021?
Yeah, so then I was really supporting other riders in the team a bit more because we did so much racing in Belgium where we had sprinters that were stronger than me. And then a lot of the racing then was about for us either getting in breakaways or, being for me helping other riders in sprints with positioning and basically trying to give them the confidence to perform against the competition we had. Also, it was just a bit unfortunate that at that time, the team basically ran flat out of money, and we were really struggling to get to the races. Basically, all of us as riders became staff members. So then it was tricky because we were getting worn out before we even got to the races, and then it was really hard to perform to the top level then. So that was a tricky time for all of us on the team, actually, because we were all obviously hoping to get to a higher level and struggling to get the best out of ourselves in those races, which we were racing. The calendar was amazing. We were able to do such high level races across Northern Europe, but none of us had the condition at that time to actually be able to perform to our best.
You joined Mayo CCN Pro Cycling Team in 2022, and your first race for the team was Tour of Sharjah in the UAE. And it started with an individual time trial, which you won. How did it feel to get that win and go into the leader's jersey as part of this new team?
That was, really unexpected. I'd done a bit of work on my time trialing in Australia. It was a road bike TT because it was more like a prologue. So it wasn't something that I had to change my position for or anything like that, which definitely helped. But again, it was, I hadn't done anything in particularly different in Australia. It was just being in a good environment, being around friends and family, being able to train really well. And came there with some really good form. When you win a time trial like that, I think it's really good for the confidence because that you can't, that's not just by luck. If you win a time trial, it shows that you had the strength to win it. So for me, that was really good for the confidence going into that season. And then it sort of showed that, okay, like again, it's not a top level race, but for sure I can be competitive at a UCI race. Basically took all the pressure off because I won the first race of the season. Then it was a confidence booster and okay, I don't have to be showing myself as much now. I've shown what I can do. Now I can just enjoy the racing. And then when you're enjoying the racing, the performances is often better, as good as it gets anyway. So that was really good then.
And you had more results in that race, and you finished third in the GC. And then in the following months, you raced in Thailand and America. Do you travel to the races as a team? Like, does it give you more of an opportunity to be with people in the team when you're traveling to not so European based racing?
Yeah, so that was at that time I was still based in Australia, and it's a crazy calendar when you think about it. Like we raced in three continents in the first 3 months of the year. So for a continental team, that's obviously a big expense, and we were all basically living at home and traveling to those races from home. So I was the only one based in my part of Australia, and then we had a rider from Latvia traveling to those races. We had riders from other parts of Australia, from Asia as well, and it was cool to be a part of a team that had riders from so many different places, and the travel was a big stretch. So well, I performed really well in Thailand. I then like came home, trained for a bit after that, and then went to the US and really suffered from the jet lag and maybe the travel, and was sick there after the travel. So also, that race was at altitude, so I felt like while it was cool to be doing that program where we were racing everywhere, it's also a big risk with the long haul flights and trying to manage that load of the racing and trying to train in between amongst all that long haul travel. So I think that's why, yeah, now when I'm in a team that's a lot more organized, where we're really careful when there is those long haul flights to races, that there's good recovery either side of this.
And was training, was it a bit lonely not being close with teammates, or did you have people to ride with when you were in Australia?
Yeah, it was a lot of solo rides, and it always has been when where I am in Druin in Australia. But for me, I really like training alone anyway, so it wasn't too much of an issue. And yeah, it was also, I'd tie in the solo, well, when I had specific efforts, it was always solo rides. But then I always, each week when I'm back home, there's a big bunch ride culture in Australia. So there's some early wake-ups for a 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. bunch ride, but it's worthwhile, even if it's just the old boys that, yeah, they're not pros by any stretch, but they still love going out there and just riding as hard as they can for an hour or two. So even joining in with them to start a ride, I could either ride on the front and it's a really solid hit out still, or just sit on and get some speed in the legs. But either way, yeah, it was never, I never got lonely riding, and then there's always a goal pretty near on the horizon of this race to go to, and then I can meet up with the rest of the team then.
Yeah. And at the end of 2022, you joined Q36.5 pro cycling team. Were you excited about this move up from the Conti level?
Yeah, for me, that was one of the most exciting days when I got the call from Doug Ryder, the team general manager, because yeah, it was a call I hadn't given up on getting it, but it's not something that I thought was really going to happen. I was 26 years old at the time, and that's pretty old to be getting a pro contract. So for me, I hadn't thought I was past it by any stretch. I knew there was improvement in front of me, but it's the yeah, it was always going to be try. It was always going to be difficult to get a contract from that age onwards. So to get that call from Doug was pretty amazing when he said, "Yep, we're going to offer you a contract." And then it really, like, I was still enjoying all the years of riding in these smaller teams and yeah, going through a lot of hardships to get to these races, let alone perform well in them. But then it makes all of that stuff worthwhile when then I got the opportunity to race with a team that, yeah, was going to be doing such a great program and such a well-organized team to be a part of that. And finally, actually getting paid to ride my bike as well was pretty special when that change happened.
So, what were you doing to earn money when you were part of the small teams?
So I worked a lot of different jobs at home. And while I was studying, I was doing Uber Eats deliveries on my bike. So I'd do a bit of training in the morning and then get in some extra miles by riding around in the evenings delivering food. And then while I was riding for the Pat's Veg team, I was working in Pat's Veg, which was basically a sauerkraut factory. Just a really small business where we were producing our own sauerkraut and pickles and that kind of stuff. So that job, then the last few years I was working in a school. So I was doing training rides to and from the school to work there, just as basically a teacher's assistant, a teacher's aide, and working with some kids that needed a bit of extra help there. So that was also really lucky that I was able to have that job and come and go from that in between races. And yeah, basically I had to just do all of my work while I could in Australia so that I could had enough money to survive overseas while I was doing these race blocks.
That's amazing that you could balance it all together, and then obviously it paid off in the end.
Yeah, and it's yeah, I at the time it was a big stretch to be able to manage the time and still have the time to train. And then yeah, now it's honestly crazy once I got the pro contract and have been based here in Europe more of the year to realize how much time I have on my hands when I'm not doing all of these jobs part time in between the riding to be able to make ends meet and still be able to ride overseas.
So after a training camp in Calpe, you raced Tour des Alpes Maritimes. How are you adjusting to being a part of the new team?
Yeah, it was really a massive difference to anything I'd ridden for before. The setup was so much more professional, but then also the expectations were a lot higher. So, yeah, before it was often just go to this race, see how you go. Let's hope everyone has a good race. Everyone kind of, yeah, try and help each other, but if you feel good, go for a result. Whereas here, it's specifically you have this job, you need to be able to do it. If you're not able to do that job, then there's a lot of questions asked from the top down. So there was, yeah, a lot higher expectations, a lot more pressure in that situation. And yeah, I think it's something I coped with a lot better than others that were new to this experience. But it's also, yeah, it definitely takes away from the enjoyment when you have that higher pressure in that environment. But as well, when you then get the results from it, it becomes really rewarding because it is truly a team effort, in the kind of team that we have to get results at the level that we're racing. So yeah, it was a big change from anything I'd done before, but I think at the time I adjusted to it pretty well, and I'd also been in the high performance environments before, which gave me a bit of a head start, I think.
March had a couple of races in Belgium, followed by some one-day races in Italy, and then a 5-day stage race in Italy. Was this quite an intense build into the season?
Yeah, I think for me, the first year it was very much the team throwing me into every race they could to try and see where I fitted in best. And it sort of worked. It didn't work out how they intended because I was able to be useful in sort of any race they threw me into. So there was some races in Belgium where I was able to position guys, and then I'd go to Italy and be one of the last guys left in the group for the climbing races to support the climbers. But then at the same time, I wasn't getting any of my own results in these races. So I was able to play a really good supporting role in all of these different races without setting the world on fire in anything and saying, hey, this is where I should be because this is where I've just won a race. So it's still something where I'm able to go into a lot of races in a lot of different areas. And at that time, the travel was again a bit of a stretch because I was, yeah, really just racing in Italy one week, Belgium the next, France the next, and really all over the place. But it was cool also to have that experience to race in so many different places under different sports directors. And then also, I think by May that year, I'd raced with almost everyone in the team. So, you know, from going from teams of 10, 12 guys to suddenly a team of 25 riders, or I think even more, then it's, yeah, it's hard to race with guys that you only see once a month tops, often even less than that. So to be able to race with so many guys so early on, I really got to know the other riders in the team, and then that helped me for the rest of the year be able to perform well with these riders.
Yeah. And you got the opportunities to do races like Brabantse Kempen and Amstel Gold. Do you enjoy having the opportunity to do the top level races?
Yeah, that was the highlight of my spring, would have been racing Amstel Gold Race for sure. It was my first World Tour race, and the crowds there are insane. And then I really thought, okay, I'm gonna be Ardennes specialist. This is my thing. I love racing here, because I really love that experience. And then it's funny how it's worked out that this year I'm not actually racing at Amstel Gold, and my program's changed completely. But it is still, those kind of races are the races I love racing at the top level. They're races that I've watched since I was a kid, and to be able to race those has been really cool. Even, yeah, this year again, just being able to race those top level races, while it's so hard to get a result in them, the experience of doing those is really special.
In May, you had lots of one-day races. Obviously, you said about you were going from place to place. Did you feel like you needed a bit of a break after doing so many races just back to back?
Definitely, I was pretty burnt out by the end of the spring in my first season. It wasn't so much the number of days, but just the travel in between, the intensity of the races. And I was really just destroying myself in these races, just going so deep. And that's not something I'd experienced before because, yeah, I'd had busy race programs, but not so much travel. And then, yeah, not just that intensity of racing. So then it was, yeah, I was really just, I was able to still get the sessions done in training and show up to races okay, but I never really felt like I was fresh and never felt like I had much zip. And even mentally, I was just struggling to feel like I really wanted to go out there and ride hard for 4 or 5 hours, like you need to be able to feel on the morning of a race.
And at the end of this block, you came down in a crash in a race. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, I'd been lucky to have no incidents the whole of the spring until that one. I just stopped behind a crash where a rider hit a traffic cone, and then someone from behind was coming back from the convoy and just smashed straight into me. And I didn't come down very hard at all, but I just hit my head really hard because the rider hit my head from behind, and that's, I think, yeah, basically the worst impact you can get in terms of concussions. So I ended up with a pretty nasty concussion from that. I had to spend a week in the Netherlands before I could fly home to Nice, and then it was a really tough period in Nice because I was trying to get out and ride, and I just kept getting dizzy whenever I'd go out and ride, and really frustrating because I just couldn't do anything. I was just basically stuck inside, couldn't read a book because I couldn't look at the thing. I was trying to avoid screens, and yeah, for anyone that's gone through a concussion, they'll know the same thing. But that was a really frustrating period and really set me back a long way that season because I just couldn't do anything. Basically, it was hard to keep any kind of activity level and impossible to train. So then it was a long road back to fitness from there.
I've had a concussion before from a crash. It's really difficult because you want to make sure that you're being safe and you're not, pushing it too much, but you really want to get back to training and obviously for you racing and going back into a season. What was that like trying to manage the safety and trying to do other things?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one because as a rider, you just get in the habit of riding. Like that's what you do at least 6 days a week. You're out there riding a bike, and to then suddenly take that away, it's really feels really alien, and it's not something that sits well with any cyclist. So then it was really tricky to hold back. The team has a really strict concussion protocol, so it made it easy to follow because I was in daily talks with the doctor. I didn't so much have a choice of, oh, should I be doing this or this? It was just stick to the protocol until I felt this sensation or this much better or didn't have any of this, then I could do this. So it was easy to stick to that chart, but yeah, just frustrating in that I couldn't do the thing that I wanted to do the most, which was get out there and ride my bike.
And you got back to training, and then you got back to racing with a 2-day race in Spain. How did it feel to be back?
That was really cool to come back in a race. I had really good form then after being on a training camp with the team at altitude. So it was good to show the team that I was going well at altitude and I'd been putting the work in at home. And then also, yeah, to come into a race situation and the team performed really well in that race too. So that was really good for me to be back around the guys. Big shock to the system being back in a peloton again, especially after a long time off the bike. And then there's always that nervousness of, will I still have it? Will I still be able to fight for position? This kind of thing. But Spain was as easy a place as any, I think, to be able to come back in. It's a bit more relaxed than the races in Northern Europe, especially at the start of the races. So it was a good place to start back up, and then from then take that form into the next races.
Yeah. When I was in Glasgow for the World Champs, I saw you riding around in Stirling, but I didn't get a chance to actually get to speak to you. But I understand that you had a bit of a different role that weekend than your usual one. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I got to go to Glasgow because I had two athletes I'm coaching were racing there. So Megan, my girlfriend, who she's cooking me dinner now, but she was there racing in the women's road race. And then Aidan Buttigieg, one of the riders that I'm coaching, he's the Maltese national champion, but he's based in Australia now, but he was also racing there. So it was really cool to help Megan prepare for the road race and then Aiden prepare for the time trial and the road race on the ground. It's not something I do often as a coach because I'm often busy with my own travel for races, But here I had the opportunity. I didn't have a race on that weekend, and it was nice to go and actually be there to, yeah, do, I guess, with a time trial, it's such a specific warm up and daily protocol to be ready for that race. So to be there to support Aiden for that, and then also, yeah, to just be there to, yeah, I think not so much pep talk in cycling, but to be there on the ground and to be able to really communicate how to prepare and also how to execute the day of the race in person, it makes a big difference, I think.
Tell me a bit more about the coaching that you do. How long have you been coaching riders?
I think I've been coaching riders for probably 5 years now. Yeah, 5 years. But like, while I was riding for teams where I wasn't getting paid, I was really trying to take on as many clients as possible just to survive, basically, while I was overseas. And then now I like to stay around the happy 8 to 10 athletes because more than that, and I feel like I'm just not doing as good a job because I just don't have the time to put in, and there's not. I'm not able to communicate as often as I'd like with riders, but it's something I really enjoy doing. It started as a side form of income. Now it's just something that I really enjoy because I enjoy helping people. I like, yeah, just that when there's these athletes that are so determined to progress in the sport, but just need a little bit of guidance in terms of basically funneling that determination, I guess, into what's going to actually help them. So you can put in a lot of effort and sort of be spinning the wheel, but getting nowhere. And for me, I like to say, okay, if you want to put this much into it, put more into this area and don't worry about this area. And then this kind of thing. And that's specific to each athlete, but it's something that I really enjoy doing and being able to share the experience that I've gained through the sport, plus the knowledge that I gained through my university degree, which also helps in that field. I think I'm lucky to be able to do it, and it's something I enjoy doing as well.
So, as a coach, what would be one training tip that you'd give to me and my listeners?
Oh, the biggest one for me, and it's probably not a training tip that people might like to hear because it's not something like you have to do this session and it'll help you. But for me, it's just make sure that you're enjoying the training. So you're not going to enjoy every session. There'll be some sessions that you hate and some that you just have to get through. But you want to look back at the end of each week and think, okay, I really enjoyed that, or I enjoy where this is getting me, and make sure that it stays enjoyable. Because if it's not enjoyable, it's not sustainable. And if it's not sustainable, then you won't get the long-term kickback and you won't get to where you want to get from it. So you have to make sure that you're always enjoying what you're doing. If there's sessions that you really hate and you dread, then try to work with your coach, or if you are coaching yourself, then try to look at, okay, how can I, is there another session I can do that will have a similar stimulus that will then, that I can do instead of this one that will get me to where I want to go, rather than if it's, you're doing anything that's not enjoyable and that's really becomes a chore, then it's going to be so hard to get the best from yourself.
That's good advice. So you had quite a busy block at the end of your season, beginning with the Arctic Race of Norway. What was the scenery like of this race?
That was really cool to do a race in that part of the world. It's some a part of the world I never think I would have gone to if there wasn't a bike race there. But honestly, the scenery was amazing for about half of the first day, and then it was very much the same. It's just completely barren there because the wind and the elements are so crazy, and obviously the 6 months of the year there's almost no sunlight. So it was a really crazy part of the world to race a bike in. It got very much same as we were racing along, and there's no trees, just rocks and open windswept. Yeah, I guess I didn't even know. It's we're racing along the coastline the whole time, but it was very much the same. But that was a really cool experience to race there, and also terrain that actually suited me with small climbs and crosswinds that I was racing well in at the time. So that was cool to race there.
Did it feel like quite tough conditions coming out of doing summer races in Europe?
Yeah, it was funny actually because I said to the team at the start of the year, I always perform well in heat, so put me in the hottest races you can. And then in August, the hottest month of the year, I was racing in the Arctic Circle, and it was 6 degrees and raining. So it's not somewhere at the time I particularly wanted to be, but honestly, if I get the opportunity to go back there this year, I'd take it because it was a really cool race and also a race that suited me as well.
Another run of lots of one-day races before you headed to the Tour of Turkey to end your season. What are some of your memories from this block?
The one day races were really challenging. For me personally, I was going well at that time of year, but I think last year, for whatever reason, the most of the classics guys had just got over raced throughout the year or were really tired. So the team wasn't performing super well. And then it was, yeah, the environment within the team was not the best just because the guys were just so fatigued and almost burnt out by that time of the season. So for me, I'd done a really varied program plus that big break in the middle of the year. So I was really keen to perform well in these. And then it was really tricky mentally because the other guys were really worn out. The staff were a little bit worn out. So then it's really tough to get results. And then it was really nice for me to finish the season then in Turkey because it was a completely different environment. A lot of riders that I hadn't ridden with so much throughout the year. And then we raced really well as a team. I think the guys that were there, while it was really the end of the season, the guys really wanted to be there. It was great weather, and the performance was really good then.
And your 2024 season started with your national champs and then back to Turkey for the Tour of Antalya. You had a big day in the break on stage three, 103 kilometers. Were you feeling good during this race?
Yeah, I started the season with really good form. So at Nationals, I was sick just before it, so and during the race. So that was really frustrating because I'd put in such a big December to be good for that race and then came in and just got sick. Still tried to race it, but was so far off my best and really just struggled there. And then came to Europe straight the day after I flew to Europe for training camp with the team and then all the testing numbers from the training camp and yeah, body composition tests and all the health tests and everything were showing that I was in the best condition that I'd ever been in, or at least the best I'd ever tested. So then it was that gave me some confidence, and I knew from the training that I was going well, but then to have those numbers confirmed with the testing with the team was good. And then so it gave me an opportunity to go to Turkey and yeah, just show what I could do there. And while I was still working in support of our GC riders, yeah, I was able to get a top 10 on one of the stages where there was a smaller group sprint at the end of the climbers that were left. And then also, yeah, that was had the opportunity to race aggressively and be in the breakaway, which that was cool to be in a breakaway on a climbing day and to be the one in the breakaway that was setting the pace on the climbs and dropping the others when in the past, in those situations, I was always the one skipping turns so that I could hide on the climbs and still get over there. So that sort of showed me that okay, I've got good condition here. The hard work that I've put in over the off season has paid off, and that was good for the confidence coming into the start of the season.
Yeah. And you had a big block of classics so far this year, starting with Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. What was it like to start this classic season with this race for the first time?
It wasn't something I expected to be doing, even at the training camp at the start of the year. I was always going to be doing two or three or four classics, but more set for a varied program like last year, where I could be used in a lot of different situations. But the classics team, we took a few hits with injury and illness. And so I got the call up to start more of the big races at the start of the year, like Omloop Het Nieuwsblad straight into opening weekend. And that was definitely a shock to the system. But then I still was in there and was feeling good in the race. While I got stuck behind a crash, like half of the peloton, I was still feeling like, okay, with a bit more luck, I can actually do something in these races. Where I was half expecting to go there and just be suffering to hold on the whole time, I was actually able to influence the race a bit already then, the first one of the year. And I thought, okay, this is good now. And then the team obviously saw that my performance was good enough there, and I got thrown into then every classic for the rest of the classics block. So it was just a case of, okay, you can do these few extra next week. And then that just kept rolling on. We had more riders get sick or injured. And then it was all of a sudden, okay, you're actually doing every single couple classic on our program. So it was a big workload to take on. And yeah, it was meant that I had to adjust, like take off other races from the program to make room for these. But it was an amazing experience to do all of these.
And so I guess when you were going into like Le Salmon and Nokkakorsa and Brugge de Panne, you didn't really have goals or anything because it was sort of unexpected that you'd be racing them.
Yeah, definitely. I hadn't thought from the start of the season, or I hadn't had time to be training and thinking, okay, this is what I'm going to get out of this training session so that I'm good enough for this race. It was always basically one of the last ones. I was one of the last ones added to the roster each time, and then it was a support role. But we also just had a bit of misfortune in the team that when I was executing these support roles well, and all of the other support riders were doing the same, we'd put our leader in a situation and we just had three or four races in a row where the leader would be in a great position and then crash in the final of the race. And it was happening not just to our team, but obviously other teams. There's so many crashes in these races, and we just had a run of bad luck where we were set for a top 10 or podium place and we'd have a bad crash. So that was frustrating because you put all the work in for the team and then the team doesn't get any result out of it, and then reflects badly on everyone in the team. So that was a bit frustrating, but that's also just part of what can happen in the classics, and also was good motivation to try and get deeper into these races myself so that there was longer that we could protect the best riders from these incidents as well.
There has been a lot of crashes this season so far. How do you feel about sort of the safety in the peloton?
Yeah, for me, I've had to ask a lot of people because it feels like there's so many crashes for me, but I'm thinking maybe it's just because this is the first year I've been racing all of these classics. That's why it feels like there's so many crashes. Maybe there's always this many. And it's a mixed response. Some people say, oh, there's always a lot of crashes. Other people are saying, no, there's so many this year. There's also the fact that more of the race is being covered. We're seeing more of the crashes. For me personally, it feels like there is a lot more. And it feels like we've changed the way we race differently because now we're not positioning for the hard sectors in the race to make sure we're in front when it might split. We're positioning to make sure we're in front when there might be a crash. So, and that there might be a crash on every corner almost. So there's all of these points in the race where we'll be coming into a town where there's some traffic islands, and the director will say, okay, everyone at the front, we need to be here in case there's crashes. So, and that's happening 10, 15, 20 times a race, but not just for our team, but for a lot of teams are saying the same thing. We're all fighting for the same part of the road, and then that's creating more crashes. So for me, it seems like there is more than ever before. I've been in more than I've ever been in before as well, from fighting to be in this position. You're riding closer to everyone else. When there is a crash, there's less time to react. So it's not something I'm enjoying. It's something I've had to change my mindset completely in races to not have any fear of crashing, because as soon as I have this fear of crashing, I'm more likely to break than the person next to me because I think, oh, what if there's a crash here? Then that happens three times in a row. Suddenly 30 people have passed you, you're near the back of the peloton. So I've had to change to the point where crashing can't be something that bothers me, or I'll be at the back of the peloton for every race. But that now crashing isn't something that bothers the whole field until it happens. So all of a sudden you've got this higher risk of crashing. So I don't know what the solution is, but I'm not liking how many crashes there are in these races.
I think for me, as a person watching at home, it's obviously we're seeing a lot more coverage, and also bigger names are crashing a lot, like in Itzula, that terrible crash with Vingegaard and Roglic, Evenepoel, and so many other riders. It's difficult to think, well, it's just this, that, and the other, because it doesn't matter how skilled you are, so many people are coming down.
Yeah, and the crashes are happening at the front now as well. Like when we were racing these races at the start of the classic season and a few guys were crashing, and the response from the directors was always just, oh, you need to ride further forward so that you're not in the crashes. But you see everyone's getting that same kind of direction from the team. And then like Basque Country, the crash was right at the front. The crash with Wout Van Aert was right at the front of the race. A lot of the crashes that we've seen in the last few classics have been right at the front of the peloton. So it's bringing more guys down. It's bringing better riders down. And yeah, I don't know what the solution can be, because obviously the crashes are caused by riders more often than not. That you get some cases with motorbikes or traffic islands or whatever, but it's mostly riders hitting each other. So then you might just say, okay, riders need to chill out, but there'll be every rider that takes it easy and sits back, then some other riders will be in front of them. And then you're just going to be at the back of the peloton because you've just decided that you're going to take it easy. And then you've got to, whenever there's a hard point in the race, ride around all of these guys that have decided that they're going to take more risks. So then everyone's, yeah, it's a never-ending cycle where everyone wants to take the risks to be at the front. So for me, yeah, I don't know whether we need to start wearing just motorbike leathers and full face helmets and just be prepared for more crashes or what the solution is. But yeah, it's a tricky one.
I mean, you might have wanted that in Arctic Tour of Norway, but I think they'll be pretty rough in the summer trying to be fully safe and covered.
Exactly. And I think now our clothing sponsor, our team sponsor, Q36.5, for example, makes a really good technical wear that has the padding, but we're not actually allowed to use it because of the UCI rules on the textiles, the fabrics that can be used, because it's more aerodynamic, having the rough surface on the exterior, on the shoulder pads and the hip pads. It's not UCI legal, but I'd like to see that change. You're always going to get teams then taking advantage of it and trying to set up their clothing so that it's more aero rather than necessarily more safe. But I think that extra protection, it's not going to stop broken collarbones necessarily, but maybe just to prevent some road rash at least, it'd be something I'd like.
When we're talking about aero, can I ask you about your thoughts on the Visma Lisa Bike TT helmet?
It's not something that I find very, it's not a helmet I like, that's for sure. But at the same time, yeah, it's a tricky one where you draw the line because, yeah, you're always going to get helmets that look stupid and that might go fast, and you get helmets that look great that might be slow, and then no one's actually going to wear them either. So for me, yeah, if it's within the guidelines, then for me, it's fine that they use it. Maybe the UCI will end up altering the guidelines so that we have helmets that look better. But yeah, honestly, I think people thought they looked really stupid. But if you took a non-cycling f fan from the public and showed them a picture of a cyclist with any helmet on, they'd say they look stupid. So really, I don't think it matters what anyone thinks it looks like. If it's functional, then it's probably useful.
Yeah. So you spent a day in the break, 136K in the break of Gent-Wevelgem. And how does it feel to be up at the front in the Flanders Fields?
That was really cool. That's a race I've always watched. Gent-Wevelgem is one of the classics that I think everyone knows. Obviously, it's not to the same level as Roubaix or Flanders, but it's one that I always watched in Australia. One that I, yeah, wasn't planning on racing at the start of the season again, was a pretty late call up for that. And then that was cool to have the opportunity for one to go on the break and then to actually make it into the breakaway of the day and to be out there for so long and riding through towns that I'd raced in way back when I first came to Belgium, though I'd go past a town and think, oh, I've done an amateur Kermes here before. This is cool. Or I was going past towns where I'd gone to check out the fields where the World War One remembrance fields where so many Australian soldiers had died, and then I was racing through those fields that I'd gone to as a tourist years ago, and in a race that actually remembers those veterans and starts in Ypres where they're commemorated. That was really cool to be a part of. And as an Australian racing on that side of the world, it was a race that was special for me. And then to be a key part in that race in the breakaway was really cool.
And you raced the Tour of Flanders and then most recently your first Paris-Roubaix. I'm sure a lot of people have heard your Hunger Games analogy after you came in as the last finisher of the race. Talk me through what the race was like for you.
It was not what I expected the race to be at all. I expected a lot of carnage because I knew every cobble sector would be chaos and there would be a lot going on. But yeah, the start was a bit of chaos going for the breakaway and then a big crash early on, which we narrowly avoided. But that was enough to scare a few people in the peloton and me included. You just think, oh, I don't want that to happen to me. And then yeah, coming into the cobble sector, a massive fight for position, which was expected, and then the very first cobble sector, I had a puncture, but a few of my teammates punctured as well, which meant that by the time I got to a spare wheel, it was already a long way, a long wait for that spare wheel. The mechanic at that station was already busy fixing a teammate's wheel, and I had the team nutritionist change my wheel, which he was very motivated to do a good job, but that wasn't his field of expertise. So he makes us some very good nutrition plans, but Unfortunately, the wheel change wasn't the quickest one I've ever had, so it took a while to get then back into the convoy of cars and then try to catch up to other riders. And by that time, when I was catching up to riders, the race was on so hard at the front that these riders were already so far out the back, they were just pulling out of the race. So then it was really frustrating for me because I just wanted to get into a group that would work together to catch back on. I knew that catching back to the very front of the race was always going to be difficult from then when you've had that bad luck. But I just wanted a group that would keep going, get the best result possible, and at least get to the finish line. I finally caught a group like this after a lot of chasing and then had another two punctures in the forest of Arenberg. So then it was a lot of ride. I had to ride through the whole of that forest on the rims. Got out of that sector, and then by that stage, we still had riders racing well at the front. So the team had gone forward to those sectors to service those riders. And then it was a lot of riding on the rims to get to the next sector to then change wheels finally with a neutral van and then get back going again. And by that stage, I was so far behind that I was solo the whole way to the finish. So it wasn't the race I hoped for at all, but I was still very happy to finish the race in the end.
I mean, I think obviously it's always known for having punctures, but it seemed like this year there were so many people getting punctures. Obviously, it's your first time, but did you feel like there was a lot of punctures left, right, and centre?
Yeah, for me, I raced GP Dinan, which was a lower level race on similar sectors, and I raced that a month before Paris-Roubaix, and that was a bit of a taste of what I was in for. But there wasn't anywhere near as many punctures in that, and I'm not sure the reason why. I think possibly because people were prepared to run lower pressures, because a lot of the sectors still had mud on them during the recon. And while it had dried up on race day, people weren't prepared to risk running high pressure. And then perhaps running the lower pressure, you're more likely to get a puncture, especially with how sharp the cobblestones are. And then also just the speed we were racing on the sectors. When you're hitting sectors at 50, 60 Ks an hour, if you hit one cobblestone at the wrong angle, then it's a puncture. And then, yeah, for most people, when they punctured, their race was done.
When you came across the finish line in the velodrome, what was it like? Were there still crowds out watching?
There was a lot more crowd than I was expecting, and there was a lot of media there still interviewing other riders or and the race winner Van der Poel. So it was pretty special still to ride across the sectors because people set up there for days before with their camper vans and barbecues and that kind of stuff. The sectors were still really crowded. It actually made it harder to ride through the sectors because there was people all over them and partying and drinking on the cobblestones. So that made it hard to keep the speed up because I was scared I was going to plow through a fan at some point. But there was really a cool atmosphere still the whole way along. And then in the velodrome as well, even if there was no one there, it would have been a really special moment for me. But to still have supporters there cheering was pretty cool as well.
And did you get to go in the iconic showers afterwards?
No, I didn't have time for that. So I had to catch a flight that night back home. And a lot of other riders had to as well. So I had to rush back to the team bus to get changed and have the team debrief as well. We had a good team performance in that race. So I think everyone wanted to finish that as a team. And yeah, I had to take the standard bus in the shower, which is probably a little warmer and a little nicer anyway. But I'll have to make sure that next time I get there a bit sooner so I can use the iconic showers.
Yeah. So what races have you got coming up?
For me, the next races will be some more one day races. And yeah, my first race back is the Famin Ardennes challenge in Belgium. So that will be, yeah, 1.1 race. Hopefully, if I can recover well after this last block, then I'll have some form coming into that and will be chasing a big result there because a lot of these top level classics we were really just looking for top 20s or to be involved in the race. Whereas once we step down to the point one and point pro level, then we're really racing to be on the podium or for the win. So for me, that'll be a big goal. Then soon after that, Eschborn Frankfurt in Germany, which is another one day race. Basically, the next block is some lumpier one day races, more Ardennes style, where, yeah, it should suit my characteristics and hoping to come in with some good form after the last block of racing as well.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
It's a tough one. I don't like to think, oh, this is where I need to be, but I'm hoping I'll be riding for a pro team still or a world tour team, either at this level or higher, and racing similar races to what I'm doing now. If I can keep, I think I can't stay at the same level because the level is getting higher each year. If you look at the speeds, if you look at the power output, I have to keep improving because everyone's improving. But if I can keep improving, then I think I will, the rest will take care of itself in terms of getting contracts and in terms of staying within teams that allow me to race at this level. I'd like to, at this point in time, I feel like I'd like to continue my career for another 10 years. So it's not something that I am sick of. I really like the lifestyle. I really still love racing my bike. So yeah, in 5 years' time, I'd love to still be racing similar races to what I've done for the last month, and hopefully with a little bit more luck.
What's your favorite race you've ever done?
Favorite race I've done would be Tour of Flanders. I also had some pretty terrible luck there. I had a crash and a really slow bike change, which took me out of the race. But the crowds there were really crazy in Belgium. Having raced so much in Belgium, it's just such a special race for me. And it really is the pinnacle of the classic season in terms of every race in Belgium leads up to that. It's also a race that suits, while Roubaix was really cool, Flanders is a race that suits me more with the climbs. It's not so much raw power in terms of there's a bit more finesse involved in being able to hold speed up those climbs. So for me, it would be Tour of Flanders, my favorite race.
Is there one race that you'd really like to do that you haven't done yet?
It's probably a common answer, but the Tour de France, for sure. Yeah, for me, living in France now, I see how much it means to the people. Then also just growing up, it was the race I always watched even before I was a big fan of cycling. It's just the race that everyone in Australia watches. The first question I get whenever I'm back in Australia and people say, "Oh, what do you do for a job?" And I say, "I'm a cyclist." They say, "Oh, do you race the Tour de France?" So it's always that number one question. It'd be great to one day do it just to make that a really quick and easy answer.
Yeah, I think it has every right to be a common answer.
Yep.
Who's your favorite current rider?
Ooh, favorite current riders. Tough one, actually. I think it would be Tadej Pogacar. Be just he is such a friendly guy. I bump into in training a fair bit here in Nice, and just the attitude that he has towards racing. He really can see that he just enjoys it. I think that's a really great role model for people, and just he's really changed the game in terms of how he's just prepared to throw the rule book out the window and attack early or attack when people aren't expecting it and race every race so hard rather than save himself for the next days. So for me, he would be my favorite rider.
Who's your favorite rider of all time?
Or my favorite rider of all time, I think it would have to, I think it would be Robbie McEwen, really. He's not a rider that I'm similar to in terms of characteristics at all. I don't have that kind of speed or sprint at the end of a race that he did, but he's someone I grew up watching. Just his ability to always be there at the end of a bunch sprint when you hadn't seen him the whole day and he'd just pop up and be in the right position to win. He's someone I idolized growing up. And yeah, now I really enjoy listening to his commentary as well and how knowledgeable he is on the races. So he'd be my favorite of all time.
Yeah, I sort of learned who he was through the hearing his commentary, and my dad sort of had to
Yep.
tell me about his history as a rider. I think he's really cool.
Yeah, it's phenomenal how many races he won. Those yeah, stats keep popping up. But as an Australian in Europe, it is so tricky to win races. It's you see some Belgians that are able to get the 30 wins in a year, and it never seems like Australians are able to do it, whereas he is one that did just take so many wins each year that he was racing, particularly in those hard Belgian races.
What's your advice for young riders?
Again, similar to the training advice, but make sure you're just enjoying what you're doing. That's the biggest thing. And then if you're able to succeed in that, you get the most out of yourself performance-wise, but you also have a long and happy relationship with the sport. I've seen so many riders that were beating me in juniors and so strong that now don't touch a bike at all. And for me, it would really seem crazy if I ever got to a point where I didn't ride at all. For sure, there's going to come a time where I'm not getting. It's not my profession, and I won't be able to ride 25 hours a week for the rest of my life. But I think I'll always enjoy riding. I'll always enjoy racing, whether it's pinning a number on, or whether it's racing my mates for a town sign sprint, but make sure that you're able to focus on the things you enjoy. And for everyone, that's going to be different. For some people, that's a long solo gravel ride for 10 hours. For other people, it's a 1 hour bunch ride. And for others, it's a bikepacking adventure or something like that. But find the thing that you enjoy, and generally that'll also tie in well with what you're good at.
What's your favorite thing to eat after a long ride or race?
I like to change it up. There's no one thing for me, and I'm not a fussy eater, but yeah, if I was to sit down at the end of a long ride, just a big sandwich would be the best one for me. So yeah, and I'll change up that sandwich each time, but a sandwich.
You've got 5 minutes before you head down to the start of a race. What's on your playlist to get you motivated?
I'm never the one that gets to choose the songs in the bus, but for me, it would be some Aussie rock, I reckon. Something like Powderfinger or Jet or Wolf Mother. So always makes me a bit nostalgic because it's the music that, yeah, my dad used to listen to and that I used to hear always around the house in when I was growing up, early teenage years. And yeah, those kind of things would definitely get me going and make me want to get out there and rip it up.
Thanks so much for sharing your cycling life story with me, Cyrus.
No problems. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much to Cyrus for chatting with me, particularly after such a busy block of racing recently. If you'd like to hear more cycling life stories with people from across the world, I've released over 140 episodes that you can find wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you have any feedback, then feel free to leave a review. I'd love to hear what you think. And if you want to learn more about me and my podcast, you can find me on Instagram @cycling.talk.podcast. See you on the bike.